Penn Jillette on the free FM CBS radio in Las Vegas, Nevada. And we've got Michael Godeau here. And we've got, do you read Scientific American?
I do.
Good. That's
I
good.
I do.
I don't. So this will be more of your interview, exactly.
Okay.
Because our guest today is John Rennie, who is the editor-in-chief of Scientific American, and you're pretty young.
Well, I'm actually, I like to say that I'm a lot older on the inside than I'm on the outside.
Well, how long have you been editor?
I've been the editor-in-chief for 12 years now, and I've been with the magazine for 17.
Wow. So you went directly to there
no, from actually, kindergarten.
Yeah, no, I people do often say that I look a lot younger than I am. I'm actually 47. So,
okay. Everything's reasonable then.
Yeah.
You just look a little younger.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's the Beatle haircut.
It's that and the fact that I cannot go out in the sun for any reason, which is why it's great to be here in Las Vegas.
it's cold now, so you're okay.
That's right.
And what did you do before Scientific American?
I was a science writer for various other publications, freelance, little newsletters nobody would have heard of before.
And was that always your dream to be a...
You know, it's funny. It's one of those things where I sort of ended up back into a job that was kind of the dream job. I remember when I was like 12 years old, I had picked up an anthology of Isaac Asimov science essays.
Sure.
And I really loved it. And that was the very first time that it had ever occurred to me that there could be a job of writing about science. And so it was something I always thought would be great to do. But I also, you know, for years thereafter, going to school and all the rest, I could never figure out why anybody would want to read something that I had written about that. But I did eventually. I started off thinking I might go on into neuroscience and be a researcher, but I changed tracks because at some point I just decided I really did want to try to write about some of this, and eventually it got me to Scientific American.
You know, we've always been cheerleaders for science, me and Godeau, because if we were to go into the sciences at our level of intelligence, we'd be the guys getting coffee, and maybe if we were lucky, we could back up some of the computer. But, you know, I've hung out at Bell Labs and at Google and been to NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab, and I think I was perhaps flattering myself. I don't think I'm quite smart enough to get coffee for those guys.
You know, I've got to say, working at Scientific American, it's a great thing for you to be able to tell your mom, because it does immediately make you sound like he's the smartest one in his kindergarten class. But I got to say, it's also a tremendously humbling experience, because I do, you know, get to routinely have experience with the brightest people in the world. And, you know, when you're sitting across a table from, like, say, Murray Gell-Mann, talking about everything in the universe, which is what Murray Gell-Mann happens to know something about, it puts you in your place.
I was able to find a subject that Murray Gell-Mann did not know much about.
Really?
And he talked to me about it for a very long time. And it really made me laugh a lot. We went out to dinner with him, and he had never heard, of course, and why would he? He had never heard of Penn and Teller. And we had done a little show, and he liked it very much.
Mm-hmm.
And liked it tremendously. And afterwards, we went out to dinner, and he was giving me career advice.
What?
And he said, there's this fellow who has, I've never seen it, but he has a program on television most every night. And I think a lot of people go on that show and do really well. Have you thought about being on that show? And I said, David Letterman? And he said, yes, David Letterman. Now, I think you should investigate that show, because maybe, and I said, well, you know, we've done it about a dozen times now. He went, well, that's what you should be doing.
Yeah, well, it's actually reassuring to hear that Murray Gell-Mann is capable of giving advice that's kind of that tin-eared to reality anymore. But that's actually really, because that would be pretty much like my high school guidance counselor saying to me, you know what you ought to do? You ought to be the editor-in-chief of Scientific American. Of course.
It's so right about that. My friend calls mom career advice. You should get on that show, Friends.
Yes.
Do a show like Friends. My mom was playing bridge with Bill Cosby's mom, mm-hmm. and this is when they were both alive. I'm not going into the afterlife. they would play bridge together. And Bill Cosby lived up in western Massachusetts, mm-hmm. so did his mom. And they were the only showbiz parents, so they'd play bridge. And that was the exact same thing. My mom called me up and said, I was talking to Mrs. Cosby, and she said you should host The Tonight Show, because that was really good for Bill. Thanks, Mrs. Cosby. No, she said that really was a big help to his career, and that you should host it. I said, well, you know, if they ask me to, I'm going to consider that seriously, because that seems like good advice. So what did Murray Gell-Mann talk to you about?
I mean, the funny thing is you would think Murray Gell-Mann might talk about physics, but I think he recognized, you know, getting a sense of the level of the room, talking to me about physics would be pretty much like me talking to my cat about literary theater. So, what I remember him talking about wines and talking about linguistics.
Uh-huh.
And the linguistics is something that
talking the drink wine.
No. Well, actually, I think we were talking wines because he was drinking quite a few expensive wines on Scientific American's tab at the time. So I think that was his motivation there.
You know, my favorite quote of Murray Gell-Mann, and sadly, he only said it to me. I wish he said it publicly. Is he said, he was talking about, at that time we were talking, this is years ago, mm-hmm. it was very fashionable among phony psychics to talk about how this stuff happened at a subatomic level.
Right.
That there was, the quarks would be separated.
Yeah. String theory supports.
Yeah. All this stuff.
All the quantum theory. Mechanics dodge that lets you get past causality, seemingly.
Yeah. And Murray Gell-Mann said, just because things get a little dingy at the subatomic level doesn't mean all bets are off. I really think that's one of the clearest things that I've ever heard said about, just because things get a little dingy at the subatomic level doesn't mean all bets are off. That's how we summed up that whole view of quantum mechanics. Who else have you talked to?
Oh, God.
Did you talk to Feynman?
I never got to talk to Feynman, unfortunately.
I did.
All right, let's
back it up.
I have a Feynman story. I met Feynman, and he came to our show several times. And I had dinner with him a few times, and he became, because I finished high school on a plea bargain, and I'm completely uneducated, and I was a magician who got into skepticism, and from skepticism got into science, because I'd have to read certain books for arguments. So I read the Feynman stuff as a skeptic, coming around all the way around the barn.
Okay.
So I got in the habit of asking him questions. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd say to him, "I'm trying to read this book," and he explained it to me. So one time we were going to do a Letterman spot, and we wanted to do a liquid air show. Mm-hmm. We wanted to have liquid nitrogen and throw a mouse into it, and then stick Teller's hand in and smash it, and all that stuff. We didn't have a connection for liquid nitrogen. And I said, and someone said, we need to find someone in physics. And I said, okay, I have a friend I can call. So I called Richard Feynman, and I said, hi, this is Ped. We're doing Letterman, and we need someone that knows all about liquid nitrogen to be able to do all those experiments and be able to get it. And Richard Feynman said, oh, it's been a long time since I did anything in, like, real physics. He said, but let me make a couple of phone calls. May I give your phone number out? And I get the greatest phone call about an hour and a half later. A guy called up with his trembling voice and said, hi, I'm Dr. So-and-so. I'm a professor at a small college in Brooklyn, and Dr. Richard Feynman called me and told me to call Penn Jillette about a bit for Letterman. It's possible this is a prank.
It is probable it is a prank, and yet.
And it was this great thing. He was a terrific guy, and he ended up being doing all the stuff for the Letterman show that we did, and giving us liquid nitrogen, and showing us all sorts of cool tricks that he did when the students weren't around. It was terrific. And the more I learned about science, and the more I learned that Richard Feynman was a magic word, you know, it's kind of, you know, I understood it to be a guy calling and saying, Eric Clapton just called me and said you need guitar lessons. You know, and even that isn't fair to Richard Feynman. So who else? Tell us some other great
ones. Oh, I actually got to meet Carl Sagan years back. He was writing something for us. And, you know, the wonderful guy that everyone would usually talk about, that was certainly true.
Yeah, he was really great.
Yeah. Stephen Jay Gould, who is, you know, of course, brilliant evolutionary biologist.
Now, what did you think of, I mean, in the Richard Dawkins, yeah. Stephen Jay Gould school, which I always thought of as the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Right.
How did you feel about the way he kind of tried so hard to kind of get evolution to be in the religious camp? He was...
Yeah, this is... Gould is an interesting guy in a lot of different ways to try to get a handle on. He was very, very bright, quite brilliant, and convinced of his own brilliance, of course, understandably. You're right. He is probably the major proponent of this idea of the non-overlapping magisteria, the idea that science has its world of authority and religion has its world of authority, and never really quite overlap. And I think that's something that I'll put myself in this camp. For a lot of years, that seemed like the good way to be able to sort of quickly move past that, because if you're not particularly looking to get into a fist fight with religious people, and you're a big believer in science, and you're a proponent of science, then that's one good way of saying, you know, we can all get along. But it is true that as a compromise goes, it's not one that holds up terribly well in the long run, simply because there are lots of religions, that make some kinds of comments about what the physical world is like. If you're a fundamentalist, if you're a biblical literalist, then you do believe that the earth was created in 6 days, and that is a physically falsifiable statement, and that's one that's going to put you in conflict with science. And the scientific side of things, you get a lot of scientists who will look at what's happening, say, in nature, and look at sociobiology in the sense of, well, how do different behaviors seem to have emerged from evolution, and sometimes start to make larger lessons out of those. They want to say, so this is these constitute the roots of morality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some cases they seem to have an argument too, but I have to say, for the most part, I kind of wish there were fewer scientists writing books about, you know, God and religion. And, you know, Francis Collins, another terrific researcher, mm-hmm. And one that I like very much at a personal level, but he wrote a book, I think last year, that came out, you know, which he was really sort of making his kind of scientific case for religion. And partly he was just talking about how he reconciled those personally, but, you know, he's also in some ways talking about how the science kind of helped reaffirm his faith, and I don't really think that holds up well.
And that was huge. I mean, the media jumped all over that as ha ha ha. See, this is a scientist. And previously, I think it was Time magazine would always do, you know, the top 10 scientists mm-hmm. talk about how they believe in God, and you'd see that the top 10 scientists all seemed to be, you know, at community colleges, different places. They couldn't get any guys high up. So he was a big find for them.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because I grew up Catholic myself, which I certainly no longer would consider myself to be, but for me it's very easy if I've got a personal longing to have a faith in religion, to me it's easy to chalk up the fact that I can't reconcile that with the physical, scientifically checkable universe by just consigning it to the issue of, it's a mystery of faith. And, I guess I'm comfortable in some ways with being able to say that people are fundamentally irrational in a way, and that they're going to have some kinds of things that there isn't going to be a perfect continuum of rationality that it covers everything that they do. On the other hand, when you get into important person, you know, pertinent affairs of how things are being conducted in the world, I mean, obviously I'm going to come down on the side of rationalism is important to that.
But, you know, a friend of mine talks about logic type tight compartments. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the figures are, and this is definitely not true, but the ballpark figures I've read is that belief in God and belief in the supernatural is about flipped in the general public to professional scientists.
Mm-hmm.
They always throw out the number of about 10%, and then about 90%, mm-hmm. or if you flip it the other way, about 90% of lay people believe in God, mm-hmm. and about 10% of scientists do. And there's this sense, and Randy, I think, was really huge, James Randi, of bringing this up, and he was the first to make this argument of a big problem is that the scientists didn't want to get their hands dirty. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to get their, you know, if you fight with pigs, you know, you end up rolling in the mud. to use a cliche that I don't think really exists.
Who said that?
I don't know. Well,
Penn Jillette.
Matt Stone of South Park said something like that with a lot of obscenity in it. And I was trying to clean it up. And I thought that when I cleaned it up, it would come out to be a cliche. But actually, when I cleaned it up, it came out to be just a horrible metaphor. So when Matt said it, it sounded really cool. But he didn't say it on the radio. He said it to me. There is a sense that if you keep those compartments not engaging, becomes a tacit acceptance. And I don't know how you feel about this. We did a Bulls hit on it this season, and I don't know how you feel about it, but some of my friends in the sciences claim that the reason that we don't have nuclear power in this country is not that Bruce Springsteen and Jackson Brown and all those guys did all the No Nukes concerts and turned everybody against it, but that scientists just took it as so obvious that this was safe and a good idea that they didn't argue about it.
That's certainly an argument. You hear that same argument made about that scientists were way too quiet about creationism fight the
exactly,
same way.
Exactly. Right. And so when you say the scientists staying out of the fray, I kind of like them moving into it. I kind of like them moving into it a little bit because we I just think they should weigh in.
Well, I guess that's, you know, I still don't quite know how I feel about this. Because I guess the question is, to my mind, as a scientist, do I have a responsibility to try to convince other people to drop their religious beliefs? Or do I, as a scientist, just with respect to the science, is it enough for me to say, look, I'm investigating the world, I can make certain kinds of statements, I can look at other things and say, yeah, that is not a real statement, that is not true. But if I'm stepping beyond that and I'm trying to convince people not to that you know you should not have these kinds of religious faith, am I still acting as a scientist, or am I acting more as a rationalist with an agenda that transcends just whatever the agenda for science should be?
Well, I would say you're acting as a human being. You know, I'm a big fan of, I do not believe in propaganda. Whenever skeptical conferences like the ones I had a few weeks back at the James Randi conference here in town, whenever that turns to, here's how you convince people. When you meet someone who believes in UFOs, here's the way to talk to them. That offends me so deeply, because I think that your job is to tell the truth as you see it. And although I don't believe that scientists have a duty to go out and proselytize and also extrapolate from the information they're really doing, at the same time they're scientists, they're also human beings.
Sure.
And human beings, I think the more you have the marketplace of ideas, the marketplace of ideas only really works or works better the more people who are involved in it. So the more people who are giving their opinions, the more opinions we have out there. So I would say that scientists definitely, as scientists, have no place addressing religion. But as people, they have a duty just like everyone else. I mean, I'm a big fan for proselytizing but not propaganda. I think those are two very different things.
I would agree with that. I think sometimes it's the labeling. When people in the general public look at somebody like Francis Collins, who's written a book, you know, it may not be clear. Are they still wearing their scientist hat, or are they wearing their human being hat? Or similarly, Richard Dawkins, when he's... Right.
But if you're going to have Collins write the book, you sure need Dawkins to write it right afterwards.
Yeah, I would agree.
This is that we're talking to John Rennie.
Rennie, sorry. That's right.
John Rennie, the editor-in-chief of Scientific America. God damn.
You'd think I'd be taller, wouldn't you?
You sure would. Heavy cat. It's Michael Goudeau, Ben Jillette. We'll be back after this. We're on the Free FM CBS radio. This is Ben Jillette on CBS Radio, Free FM, and I'm sitting here with Michael Goudeau. If you want to write to us, it's penradio@gmail.com, penradio@gmail.com. I almost forgot that whole thing. And then penradio.com is our website. We're not taking any calls, so don't bother. If you call in, you know, maybe someone will pick up the phone, but it's very, very unlikely. Our guest is John Rennie.
Rennie. I swear I'm not changing.
Take a swing
seconds.
At him next time.
Do you know how many times I ran that back and forth in my head, and then finally decided I think
in
this
that
is
millisecond
the right
thing.
Yeah.
To be fair, if it tests well with your audience, I could change.
Okay. So when you were at the Randy conference,
right?
The TAM 5,
mm-hmm.
here in lovely Las Vegas, you gave a talk about Scientific American's involvement.
Yeah, that's right. Our glorious past over the 160-some years that the magazine's been around of being involved in debunking and skepticism and various ventures.
Well, since
that
you did all
had.
That work, let's repurpose.
Well, why not? What the heck? Sure. I always talk about that the golden age, I think, for Scientific American and its ghost-busting time was back in the 20s when it did some...
Shouldn't the golden age of Scientific American be what your editor-in-chief?
You would think so, wouldn't you? And yet, apparently...
You need to step up, man.
I'm sorry, but based on the mail, I am apparently an abomination and a blot on the fine, fine reputation
it's
of Scientific
because you're too
American.
Short.
You know, that's really hurting coming from you,
sorry,
Michael.
Yeah.
I've got to
say. I'm
a
big guy that I am.
It is true. That I do get... Of course, most of the people who are telling me that I'm an embarrassment are a lot of the creationists and the various other, you know, the...
When did Scientific American come out in favor of creationism in their life?
You know, I think, you know, we've gone back and forth on it so many times. We actually...
The debate is on.
Yeah, you know, actually, one of the things is probably one of the things I'm stupidly proudest of having done and having actually helped to write. It was April of last year, our April issue, we did a sort of April Fool's editor's letter called Okay, We Give Up. And I'm not going to be able to quote it all, but basically we start off by saying, well, you know, for years people have said that we at Scientific American should stop mixing politics and science, and we should be more open-minded on the subjects of creationism and similar subjects. So we've thought about it a long time, and okay, you were right. And so we just basically apologize after that. That, you know, we talk about the fact that we foolishly let the scientists with their mountains of evidence blind us to this. It was so obvious, of course, we should have just been trusting the Bible instead. But the all new Scientific American, we said that is going to be great. That we because there we have a proper sense of the only science we're trusting is completely balanced science, in which you take all the real proven facts and the unproven. In fact, because honestly, why discriminate for that reason?
Mandatory false dichotomies.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And you decide.
And so when was the golden age of debunking, except for the present one?
Well,
your,
of course. That's
your,
right. Yes, right.
On
so,
your watch.
That's right. Mine is the aluminum age. But the golden age, the golden age was probably back in the 1920s, mm-hmm. Because Scientific American was very actively involved in simultaneously doing this sort of big ghost-busting effort and going after medical quackery. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of both at the time because you were still at the at least the tail end of big spiritualism
so
movement.
So good that that's all over now.
Oh,
that
yeah.
All that spiritualism.
What
that
were
medical
they
quackery,
thinking?
We got over that. It only, you know, it took us a long time. It took us like, you know, 90 years. But finally that nightmare is over.
And, of course, Scientific American is responsible for having ended that terrible offense. Yeah. Back in the, I think, starting back in like the early 20s, Scientific American put out a contest, a competition which they were offering two $2,500 prizes to any spiritualist who could provide first a kind of photographic evidence of, you know, the sort of miasma from beyond the ectoplasm. If they could show a good photograph of that passed judgment with the panel they were going to establish, and also some other kind of physical demonstration that they were in contact with the beyond. And you got this group of Scientific American editors and some other psychic investigators who were coming together, and Harry Houdini.
Yeah.
And this was
See,
great.
You can have someone who's not educated. You can come to them. We're here available. If you need a dumbass.
You're testing electroshock therapy. Mr. Gillette and I will be happy to help you.
I mean, there is a long
tradition.
Would
you put your tongue on this? We're in.
If you need dumbasses, just keep us in mind for the dumbasses, okay? Give me that smart stuff. Don't come to us. But for dumbasses, we're there. So you had a whole panel of illustrious scientists and one dumbass.
Well, you know, but the greatest escaped dumbass in the world. Let's be fair to them. Right. And they would go around. They would check out different 10 different seances. And they, you know, Houdini in particular was very good, obviously, at being able to show how they were pulling off the fakery that they were in these various seances. And this... I should say that when you go back and you read the accounts from month to month, because they would be writing about the seances they would attend, it became very clear that at least one of the editors of the magazine who was on this panel, a guy named J. Malcolm Bird, was actually pretty sympathetic to the position of the spiritualists. He kind of believed that there was something going on. He wanted to believe it very much. And the tension that was in there all came to a head when they decided to check out the case of a medium who was, for a while she was being operating under the name Marjorie, but that was actually a sort of pseudonym that one of the editors gave her. Her real name was Mina Crandon, I believe. And
her granddaughter lives in New York City.
No kidding.
Yeah, and she's a friend of ours. Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
She has really cool stuff. She has letters between Houdini and her grandmother that people had not seen.
Oh, well, then you know what this whole story goes.
Please tell people that.
So, Mina Crandon was really a very persuasive medium in the eyes of a lot of people.
She did it nude.
Ah, well, this was the thing that helped.
And she had them reach in for the ectoplasm, sir. What they were essentially doing was heavy swing scenes and inviting Scientific American to them.
And that would account for...
Absolutely.
From what I've been reading up on this, you know, you talk all the time about how it's very important in science that you want to maintain a detachment from what you're studying. Sure. And this is a perfect example,
especially if you're studying leeches.
In this case, they really lost attachment, because it was not just the case that the investigators from Scientific American in this case were staying in the Crandon's home, and that
they were banging her.
Well, that's right. Malcolm Bird was apparently actually having an affair with her on the side, yeah. and
from the back,
yeah,
in every way possible. They had, and I've talked to her granddaughter about this, it was just this weird sexual kink where they did this. Of course, I get in a lot of trouble for saying that Mother Teresa was just a sexual kink, but they had this weird thing. You know, she would, if you see some of the pictures that they did during this time, she would have a robe and she would strip completely naked, and she'd be sitting there with these, and forgive me, hardcore geeks, you know, holding on to her. Hold me down as I'm naked and let's see if we can find the spirits. And, you know, the Scientific Americans are going, solid. Yeah. I'm down with that.
I predict a good evening.
So for a long time, the Scientific American team was observing Mina at work. Well, Houdini, I think, was actually still off on tour. He had not been brought in on this. And the word got back to him that it sounded like Scientific American was actually about to give this prize over to them. So he got very upset about this. He felt it would discredit him. He shows up to start being there for some of these.
And of course, $2,500 divided 10 ways, that's not bad for a few good nights of entertainment.
That's right. So, Houdini, with the night this all came to a head, so to speak. Yes. He, I think, had put like an elastic of some kind, something around his leg so that it had swollen up during the day to make the skin of his leg much more sensitive. And he's positioned himself.
That's what he tells us now.
Yeah. We think it was his leg. Yeah. But whatever it was, it was in a position where when Mina would be moving things with her feet secretly, he could detect that motion. And he then, you know, he jumps up, he denounces her as a fraud, and there's an uproar at this point. And according to some descriptions, it sounds like Houdini and Malcolm Bird actually got into like a fist fight that started to spill out into the street. That may be over. I don't know. I like to think that's the case.
Of course you would.
Of course I would. This pretty much marks the end of Scientific American.
You don't want to like relive this by hitting a magician today, do you? Please don't. I don't want to spill out into the rim in a big kind of Borat naked fight as we roll into the lobby.
He hit him like this. I'll get it. There goes the phone.
That's security. So, yes, it's, yeah. they had quite a little tiff.
It really did. It was a pretty bad scene. And thereafter, Scientific American's big spiritualist hunt sort of dissolved quietly. And they never did give the prize to anybody,
Houdini was published in Scientific American, wasn't he?
I think he was involved in writing some of these sorts of reports. Yeah. He had some of those.
A lot of the smart money says, that Houdini... Houdini couldn't bust Marjorie, so that he planted a reaching rod on her. Much of the really smart money says that Houdini was actually cheating for the side of right.
Interesting.
Or as we all are fond of saying, two wrongs do absolutely make a right. But Scientific American didn't publish any final findings on Marjorie?
No. I mean, they had that account in which they described the blow-up of that scene, and they basically decided that, no, they couldn't give her the prize. And they sort of never officially said, okay, spiritualist hunt over. You just sort of stopped seeing more accounts of
that.
And
what happened? You know what happened to Byrd after that?
He actually, for a while thereafter, did write more accounts of, his own conversations with psychics, and he published a book about that. And he stayed with the magazine for quite a few years and was involved, actually, with some of the medical quackery investigations in which he apparently did not make a horse's ass of himself.
Because they kept their clothes on.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily, but...
We're going to talk about medical quackery in a little while. We're going to take a little break. We're talking with John Rennie, of the editor-in-chief of Scientific American.
The child of Ren and Stimpy. Yeah. It's Rennie.
Rennie. And Michael Goudeau, and my name is Penn Jillette. We're on CBS FM, free FM. Yeah, this is Penn Jillette on the Free FM CBS Radio, PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. That was the Mike Jones Enormous Orchestra playing that swinging theme.
Who's playing bass on that?
That's me playing bass on that. No. Thank you for pointing it out, Michael Goudeau. And we are here with John Rennie.
First time you got it right.
That's right.
Perfectly natural. Bravo.
Perfect. John Rennie, who is the editor-in-chief of Scientific American, talking about when Scientific American went a little nutty in the 20s and let a magician work with them. And you're telling us the Houdini story with Marjorie. And there was also a lot of medical quackery that did that time?
Right. This was also the golden age for medical quackery because of, radio waves, x-rays, all those kinds of things were still fairly new. People didn't understand them. People weren't comfortable with them. And so somebody could come in and make a claim that, using radio waves, they might be able to diagnose or cure a problem. That was something that there was a lot of that was going on, and Scientific American moved in on one particular big practitioner of this named Albert Abrams, who had a very, very popular fad called the Electronic Reactions of Abrams, ERA, and this was a huge fad, big enough that it actually got under the skin of the American Medical Association, and they kind of did the equivalent of trying to put out their own sort of hit squad on this to take this down, because people were going to Abrams practitioners a little too often. They were cutting in on the business, and so Scientific American put together this. And again, an investigative committee in which they spent a year laboriously going through these things. They found one of these guys who was a practitioner of this electronic reaction process, and they checked it all out. And it was a ridiculous, ridiculous process. I mean, at this point, it sounds preposterous. You can't believe anybody would fall for it, because, of course, we don't have anything like,
Exactly, no.
No, aromatherapy is bona fide. There's no problem.
I got Q-ray, man.
Yeah, exactly. No, what's also great is that you can look at this and you can see that Abrams' quackery continued to grow in a way that was really, really gratifying. He started off with this idea that he would have a patient would first give a sample of blood, and the sample of blood would be dropped into this device that Abrams called a dynamizer. You know, nobody knew what was inside the dynamizer, but it was, you know, it looked kind of like a radio. And it had these wire leads that would come off it that would attach to the patient. The patient would stand facing west, had to face west, and then the specially trained...
Where were the electrodes attached? Another one of your weird sex stories?
They had to take off at least their shirts, because, as you'll see, although the electrodes seemed to go, like, to somebody's head, and there may have been different positions for various
diagnoses.
Yeah,
you had to face Adam West.
Holy quackery, Batman.
That's sort of Batman reference. You are so up to date.
Yeah, and I was waiting for it, too.
You just had in your head, Adam West.
I had to type it out so I wouldn't forget the name.
Wendley ties in Burt Ward, who played the Green Lantern.
Yeah, go, right. Now
who played the Green Lantern?
I don't know.
Because Kato was Bruce Lee.
Yeah,
I think we're off the subject.
We have the editor of Scientific American.
And we're talking about Bruce Lee playing Kato with the Green Lantern in the 60s.
Yeah, your science is fascinating, but did you see...
if the Flash were racing Superman.
Yeah, you guys never checked any of this stuff out.
Never.
Sadly, Scientific American never had that article. That would have been the one thing.
Okay, so you have electrode attached to your head.
So you have electrode attached
shirt
to your
off,
head. And the
your blood's in the radio, and you're facing west. We were listening.
Oh, you are good. The specially trained practitioner comes over and would then just sort of would tap on your abdomen, would just like tap, and listen for these sounds, for supposedly a kind of hollow sound that was coming out.
Are these sounds amplified at all?
It's very hard to say quite that. What the heck was going on with this thing? Because you had somebody else looking at, like, the dials on the dynamizer, and this guy who was, you know, listening to the sounds and making notes. And on the basis of all of this, he claimed he could make diagnoses of any kind of illness that was wrong with you. He then, a few years later, he took it to the next step, because, after all, making a diagnosis is one thing. What you need is a cure.
Absolutely.
Let's bring out the acyloclast. The acyloclast, another mysterious device that could, you know, basically work like the dynamizer in reverse and would painlessly use radio waves to somehow restore the proper balance inside your system and fix whatever was wrong.
I wanted to point out that our radio show does that. It fixes whatever's wrong inside of you. We've got radio waves. Let's use them. Sure. Just face Adam West. I hate you. I just hate you. Go ahead. Right.
I'm not really sure there's much of a point, but all right.
You know, he did. Adam West did a few kind of softcore pornos where you get to see the bat pole. He really did. He really did a few softcore pornos, but that's also off the subject. So he came up with this.
Dear Mom, Scientific American is not as nearly as interesting as the following subject. Adam West, Green Lantern. So he was using the acyloclast, and he kept getting more and more ambitious. After a while, Abrams said that he could use his devices to diagnose what was wrong with you without you actually even being there. Just give him a blood sample. In fact, after a while, it didn't even have to be a blood sample. A handwriting sample was good enough. After a while, he was using a photograph. And he was getting more stuff. He could not only tell you what was wrong with you physically, he could tell where you were. He was identifying where people were on the map. It was getting more and more ambitious. And, you know, you had...
Ambitious is the word you use?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm trying to build my vocabulary.
Ambitious, preposterous. So, enter Scientific American. They're doing their committee about this.
Fun times they showed up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they were out there in the wings. Well, they had to finish up with Mina first.
Was Bird cruising them?
There was a certain overlap in this, when it had to be a very interesting time. But so they came in and they had to start testing this. And this was actually a model of like perfect skeptical inquiry, in which they didn't come in and just say, you guys are obviously all frauds. They said, oh, all right, well, let's find out more. Let's test this. And they started off by taking six test tubes that were filled with extracts of different sorts of disease organisms, like you had syphilis, you had gonorrhea, typhus, and...
They got all those from Marjorie.
Then they gave it to the Abrams practitioner and said, you know, just identify what's in these. And it was actually amazing. Six out of six dead wrong in every way. Just didn't even by chance get one of them to match up.
Did they
right.
give him what six they'd given him?
Oh, yeah. They eventually they did. I mean, they did repeated.
No, what I mean is, did they?
Oh, yeah. No, he knew.
Six
tests. He knew what they
these
were.
These are the six choices. Yeah. So you couldn't have like a bowler or something that they didn't even know. Okay. Go
no,
ahead.
No. Yeah, that's right. He had a limited universe of just. I mean,
he got them all wrong.
That's right. He got them all wrong. He got them all wrong repeatedly, and they kept saying he kept trying to explain why it was. And after a while, he was saying, "Oh, well, the problem here is the." You used red ink when you labeled this. The redness of the ink is throwing off the readings that we're getting okay. from this. So they would keep going through this, and he never really got any better about any of that. So they kept doing month after month. They would, you know, they would show that it wasn't working, and the practitioner would come up with sort of an excuse for why, and they would come back the next month and say, well, okay, here's a new test. Let's check this out. And they did this over the space of a year. And just exhaustively showed that there was nothing to this. Big surprise in retrospect. I mean, eventually they even did one of the things that the practitioners were bound not to do. The guys who'd sign up to learn how to do this, they had to sign an affidavit saying that they would not for any reason open up the dynamizer or the assault and look inside. That there would be legal penalties.
No user serviceable
right.
parts.
But eventually somebody, I think the AMA was involved in this too, they did actually get hold of one of these boxes and open it up, and would you be shocked to discover that inside of it was just a rat's nest of various wires attached to these meters. It wasn't doing anything.
I am surprised. I would expect nothing. I would expect just a rock just box. A rock at the bottom. But didn't recently, maybe that was under your watch, didn't Scientific American do some memory water tests?
No, that would have happened maybe a long, long time ago.
No, the homeopathy that Randy was involved with. Was that Scientific American or some other quack journal?
You know, I remember that Nature had
published, Nature?
Right,
Nature.
Nature had published papers some years back by, what's his name, Jean-Paul Benveniste, I think?
Yeah.
Yes, in France. And, right, I mean, this was, you know these studies in which seemingly they were getting the kind of homeopathic dilutions, and they were saying that they were getting some sort of difference in the properties of the water. Even though at this point there was not a single molecule of the original substance left in there.
As I think Randy said at that time, it was like throwing your car keys in the Nile and trying to start your car in Miami. There was some quote like that talked about that. But has Scientific American done committees since then?
We haven't done anything like that in a long time. These days we've got Michael Shermer, who's the head of the Skeptic Society. He writes a monthly column for us, so he's constantly weighing in on that. I've actually done a couple of different articles myself in which I've taken shots at different things like creationism and so forth. We did an article a few years back called 15 Answers to Creationist Nonsense, and that got me good and hated.
I believe I read that one.
Yeah,
it's
that sort of thing. So, there are a lot of different people.
Don't let me tell you how to run your magazine.
Oh, go ahead.
But I think get yourself a little committee, a few hookers, some ectoplasm, sit around the table and get into fistfights with magicians.
Can I mail order the ectoplasm, or do I have to go get it fresh?
I think you want to get it fresh. It's the journey that matters with the ectoplasm, I suppose. And you will be editor-in-chief of... You're not going to move on from there, are you?
Where would I go? What would I do?
Yeah.
I'm spoiled for actual work now.
Jugs? Maybe Jugs is looking for an editor-in-chief. You could move over there, do something slightly different. We have John Rennie.
Nicely done.
Why don't you just go for John Rooney? It seems like a safer bet at this point.
John, Rennie.
There
John,
you go.
John Rennie, who's here, the editor-in-chief of Scientific American, telling us about the history of the golden age of skepticism in Scientific American. And, it was fun to talk to you.
It's been a little chunk of heaven for me, too.
little chunk of heaven, which may or may not exist. 11:31? You want to go a little longer?
Another 30 seconds?
Yeah,
it's our show. What do you want to talk about?
So when I was growing up anyway, and then when I was in fourth grade.
Okay, the show. That's it.
Okay, now we'll bring in the music. This is the Mike Jones, huge orchestra playing the Ben Gillette theme. I am Ben Gillette. We're on Free FM, CBS Radio. Thanks a lot, Joe. Oh, there's ectoplasm. Ooh.